Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today to discuss our top 10 films of 2015, it's Amanda Waltz.
Hello, Brian.
Hello, Amanda. Also here is Nick Newman.
Howdy.
Howdy. How are you doing?
Today?
Yeah, today.
I had a really great weekend, and then my second favorite musician died, so it's been an interesting one. But incidentally, pretty much the whole weekend was anchored around celebrating David Bowie in ways both direct and inadvertent. So,
okay,
it was an interesting way to end it, I will say. Mm-hmm. I have been listening to a lot right now. I'm not literally right now, but at the moment I'm going through Scary Monsters and Super Creep, so you know. Can't all be bad, you know?
No, of course.
Yeah.
Very nice. All right.
Well, we are here today to do nothing less than define the entire year of 2015 in movies in a top 10 list.
Better late than never.
Better late than never. This is true. At the same time, want to spice things up a bit. So I have a die here, a six-sided die, and every once in a while I'm going to roll it. And whoever's turn it is going to have to answer a question as
Ooh.
Determined by the die. So, for instance, it just rolled six, and I feel like picking on Amanda.
Yeah!
So Amanda.
Yes?
Number six. What was
Number
your
six.
Favorite title of a film this year?
Oh, man, that's interesting. I want to say Bone Tomahawk.
All right.
Because, man, do I want to see a movie called Bone Tomahawk?
All right. So expect some of that interspersed with our going over of the top 10 lists of the year. Let's roll through what our 11 to 15s would be if you happen to have them, our what you would call honorary mentions. I'm going to go first. 15 would be It Follows. 14 would be Faults. 13 would be Mad Max, Fury Road. 12, Hateful Eight. And 11, Clouds of Sils Maria. Is anyone else capable of doing this right now?
I can.
Okay, Nick Newman.
Go ahead.
15 would be Carol by Todd Haynes. 14 would be The Sweet Blood of Jesus by Spike Lee. 13 would be Experimenter by Michael Almereyda. 12 would be Bridge of Spies by Steven Spielberg. 11 would be Magic Mike XXL by Gregory Jacobs.
Wow, 11.
That's pretty high.
I do love it.
Can you do this?
I would be able to do it, but the phone that had my list has suddenly just decided to freeze up, so I can't access it anymore.
All right, instead, I'll ask Nick to answer number four. Who was your favorite character in a movie this year?
Oh, that's a good one. I would probably have to go with Matthew Almerich's sort of snooty, murderous, bourgeois type in Guy Madden and Evan Johnson's The Forbidden Room. Have either of you seen The Forbidden Room?
Have not.
I think it is going to be available very soon on DVD and Blu-ray. It is, well, let's just say I'll get to it later when I say that it is a great, great film and a very complex movie with about 100 moving parts. And that one character, despite only being in it for about 6 out of 120 minutes, is kind of the heart of the movie. And he's played by Matthew Almerich, so he also has that going for him.
All right. Well, let's get into our top 10s. Amanda, number 10.
Actually, go with Nick because... You know, I had the list up, and then my phone just crapped out on me.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Nick Newman, number 10.
My number 10 film of 2015 is a movie called La Sapienza by this guy named Eugene Green, who is an American expatriate who now lives in Paris and is not a native French speaker, as his cameo in the movie will very clearly show, but is nevertheless a how do I describe this movie? So have you guys seen Certified Copy?
Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah. This is kind of like Certified Copy if it was less about a mystery and more about people who live exclusively in sleep deprivation chambers but somehow have a degree in art history, is okay. What I would say. The thing about this movie is that it primarily concerns this middle-aged couple who are in kind of this marriage that's turned loveless, very acrimonious even. And when they talk to each other, they talk in this very flat, affectless tone that basically tells you everything you need to know, never betrays a certain sense of internal horror, let's say. And they run into this brother and sister couple, and the sister has this sort of mild but frequent illness that gives her basically dizzy spells. So they kind of split up. Male and female go their opposite directions, and along the way they sort of learn things about their relationships, about art, about life, about architecture, all of those things, which kind of sounds like a very pleasant movie that would maybe not leave much of an impression. But I think the reason I'm putting this here, particularly at number 10, is because it kind of encapsulates a lot of things that I liked in movies in 2015. I think they'll be particularly affected by my number 9 choice, which I almost considered double featuring this with. I was really pretty fascinated by the whole thing. And I think that what basically Eugene Green does is he breaks it down where after a while, the way these people speak to each other becomes more and more natural and kind of that veneer is stripped away. So it's basically one very obvious gesture making way for another very obvious gesture, but a lot of complexities come up between them. It's a really fascinating movie and I liked it quite a bit. It's on Netflix Watch Instantly, so it is there. It's relatively short. It's like 100 minutes, I think. So La Sapienza, I decided to top 10 at 10.
All right. Amanda, are you ready?
Oh, yeah, I'm ready.
Okay.
Number 10. Do you not believe me?
I don't. I will when I hear it.
My number 10 was actually Peter Strickland's Duke of Burgundy, which I like to call 50 Shades of Grey for realists. It's this really kind of an alternate universe. I think the film is presented in this really strange world where it seems that only seems to be inhabited by women. And it examines this relationship between these two women who are in a dom sub relationship. And the way it unfolds is really brilliant because in the beginning, you think that one of the women who is older and she's a respected academic, and I think she's a butterfly expert, which is where the name of the film comes from, because Duke of Burgundy is a butterfly
type. I'm glad I finally know that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a confusing title, but you think she's the one in charge because she's the more educated woman. She's older. She seems like obviously that she has a grasp over this younger woman. But then over the course of the film, it turns out that is not the case. And it shows like the complexities of, I think, just relationships in general. And honestly, I think it's one of my favorite films because it answers a question I've had, which is, you know, we as a society are so obsessed with these sort of like alternative relationship, just this whole, like, you know, the BDSM and, you think those get boring, just like any other relationship. You know, they get complicated. You know, people aren't satisfied anymore. And I think that movie, I think the film really presents that in a way that I think is really grounded in reality, but also very funny. And also it's shot beautifully. It's so lush and the costuming is just absolutely beautiful. So yeah, I think it's just overall a very intelligent and very beautiful film with nice humorous bits. So and it's something that I was very surprised because I'm not a huge Strickland fan. Barbarian Sound Studio was not, you know, I wasn't that crazy about it, but I'm also not into giallo and stuff like that. So But yeah, I really liked it, so.
All right. My number 10 is Amanda's choice for best title of the year, Bone Tomahawk. This is a movie that has only grown in my estimation as I've thought it over. It's great. It's beautiful. It's well shot, beautifully, like really perfectly paced, with great performances and great dialogue. So that's going to be the end of my defense of Bone Tomahawk.
Since yours was so short, can I do my honorable mentions really quick?
Yes.
Okay, I'm gonna do Hungry Hearts, Buzzard, Uncle John, A Pigeon Sat on a Branch Reflecting on Existence, and Appropriate Behavior.
Okay. Nick Newman, number 9.
Well, I was not kidding when I said that my number 9 goes in accordance with my number 10, because my number 9 is Clouds of Sils Maria by Olivier Assayas, which is a movie that I saw in September of 2014, which is a little while ago, I'll admit. But it's a movie that hasn't dimmed, in my opinion, at all, and I find that sort of the oddities and the complexities and the mysteries of it have only grown stronger. And I think that one of the things about it that's kind of sat with me most is that I was glad I, even though I was taking a long sabbatical during the spring for kind of school and personal reasons, I was glad I hopped on that podcast to talk about it, because I thought it was good to kind of verbalize my thoughts about it. And I was thinking about one thing I said, and I might as well quote myself because I'm talking here, is one of the things I like most about this movie is that it's a movie where that's filled with people who are deceitful and selfish and shallow and depressed, but nobody in this movie is a villain. This is a movie that makes room for a lot of people of a lot of different types and has sympathy for all of them, despite mm-hmm. all of the ways in which they might be at times even kind of shitty. And also just I think that, you know, Assayas's sense of space and pacing and rhythm is so my thing that I sort of have a hard time not immediately responding to it. And there's at least one other movie on this list that is made by a director whose thing is so my thing that's difficult for me not to respond to it. And that sort of makes my own general response a bit more mysterious, because I can't quite... It's like my appreciation of this movie is sort of ingrained in the very fabric of it, in a way. And that's not even... I haven't even mentioned, you know, both Binoche and Stewart, who are a cinematic duo who I wish would kind of become a Martin and Lewis type of dramatic European art house cinema, if that was possible.
Yeah, although this film was actually my number 9 up until, like, last week.
Ah.
So,
yeah.
So anyway, Clouds of Sils Maria.
All right. And because you chose a film that was on my honorable mentions, I'm going to make you do another dice roll.
All right. I like these completely arbitrary rules that are
I like this film critic RPG we're doing right now.
Number 1, what is your favorite line in a movie this year?
Holy moly.
I would love it.
You remember?
I think it might be in a movie that will be appearing this later, which is John McGarry's The Mend, when one character says to the other, it's one brother says to the other, "For as long as I've known you," and the other responds, "For as long as I've known you, what the fuck does that even mean?" Which I think captures the confusion and frustration and awkwardness of brotherhood in one line better than pretty much anything I've experienced myself, or at least seen or heard myself. So that might be my favorite line.
All right. Amanda, number 9.
Yes. My number 9 is White God by, Cornel Mondrusco. I have no idea how to pronounce his last name. I'm usually pretty good at pronouncing names, but so this film is the way I describe this film is if Sergei Eisenstein and Richard Adams collaborated on a film, because it is really quite dramatic. It's basically the story. It's a very simple story about a girl and her dog. She's forced to abandon her dog because of some ridiculous rule about having mongrels in the city that she lives in Budapest. And so you know, it's basically this dog's journey home, but man, it is not the incredible journey. Some horrible things happen to this animal that basically turn him against man. He rounds up a bunch of other abandoned and abused dogs, and they just wreak havoc on Budapest, and it is pretty remarkable. I mean, I really think that this is one of the most just, I think just in terms of just sheer scale, you know, the idea of releasing, I think it was something like 230 dogs on a city, on like a major city, is so incredible to me. And, you know, the story is, I mean, it's, like I said, it's a familiar story, and it's also, I'm a huge fan of, you know, I say Richard Adams, like, Watership Down is probably one of my favorite books, but, you know, there's also a film, there's also a book he wrote called Plague Dogs that I think would make a very interesting companion piece to this film. And, you know, it's very emotional. It's very bittersweet in a lot of ways. And there's the dogs, the two dogs who play the main dog, are actually very good actors. I mean, I feel kind of ridiculous saying that, but they really are. And I think what the film is trying to do is, you know, I think a lot of people take issue with books and movies trying to sort of place human emotions and human motivations on animals, which this film definitely does. But I think in this case, it definitely works because here's, I don't know, I think it really just plays into the overall, just the overall tone of the film. But I don't know, I really liked it. I was really moved by it. And I just thought it was kind of like a huge feat that was pulled off very well, just in general.
All right. My number 9 is Hau Ha, starring Viggo Mortensen, directed by Lisandro Alonso. We talked about this on the show, and this one gets in there for absolutely stunning photography.
Mm-hmm.
A very compelling lead turn by Viggo Mortensen. And for being a headfuck movie that is worth the headfuck and actually might have something to say beyond, haha, I fucked your head. I don't know why you two keep talking so much. I mean, like, what was that?
Do you want to rephrase that? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I think I'm good. This is a good movie that is compelling as hell and ends in a way that is both perplexing and yet deeply meaningful.
Mm.
And that is why it is my number 9. Hau Ha. So, Nick Newman, number 8.
My number 8 film of 2015 is Christopher McQuarrie's Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, which for me is the best action spectacle of 2015. A very cleanly shot, very cleanly cut, cleanly structured movie that somehow doesn't feel sterile or manufactured or convenient in the way that its plot twists and turns and its action scenes unfold. This is a movie that basically had me, not necessarily pinned to my seat, but had me engaged with every step of the way, even when I think that it has to hit some less engaging, more perfunctory, interstitial narrative beats to kind of move along. But I think makes up for that in how quickly it does so. Yeah, I don't know. I was taken with pretty much all of it. I think that, you know, the action scenes in particular just kind of, for me, I feel like a gold standard in a certain kind of an uncertain time of action filmmaking, at least in studios, where there's kind of this tension between digital and physical work, which I think this movie straddles very, very well. I had a really wonderful time with it, so I felt like putting it on here.
This is both a surprise and not a surprise, because this is a damn good movie. I guess I don't picture you as taking the populist choice ever.
Well, right. Here we are.
Yeah, I know. I really don't know what to say beyond that. Other than Amanda Waltz.
Yes.
Number 8.
Number 8 is sort of a underdog for me. It's Der Samurai by Till Klenert. It's a movie that I reviewed in 2014 when it was on the festival circuit, and I was really looking forward to it coming out in 2015 so I could possibly put it on my top 10 because I loved it so much. But I don't think it ever came out in theaters. I think it was released straight to DVD Blu-ray, which is extremely disappointing because this is a very just wonderful movie. It's very, how do I put this? So basically it's this film about this cop who lives in this remote town and works in this remote town on the Germany-Polish border. And he has to basically take down this cross-dressing, very masculine, very just insane man in a dress who is just wrecking havoc on this town with a samurai sword, killing people. And so it's just this, it's a very strange movie, but it also is, I think Klenert called it a queer thriller, which I think that very much underserves it. I think the film is really about just man sort of like literally embracing his primal, like his most primal instincts. And the person who plays the cross-dressing samurai, Pitt Bukowski, is just incredible. I think I compared him to Klaus Kinski, just in terms of he has this very wild, very feral energy about him. And the movie is just, I mean, it's shot beautifully. There's this incredible chase scene through the forest at one point where basically the only light is this flashlight that the cop is using. And it just looks so incredible. And, you know, it's a great movie. It's exciting. It looks great. Has some great themes. So, yeah, I just really wish that it had gotten more promotion, and I really wish that it had actually come out to theaters in the U.S., which I don't think it ever did.
All right. My number 8 is Ex Machina. This stars Donald Gleason, our collective boyfriend Oscar Isaac, and was directed and written by Alex
Garland.
Hey,
I'm still waffling.
Oh, really? Oh,
that was established.
Hop on board this train, bro.
I'll be his buddy, but am I gonna go further than that?
Come on, throw him a bone, Nick.
Throw him a bone, yeah.
And it also stars, of course, Alicia Vikander. I just thought this was a really well-made, tense little film. Fantastic acting, especially from Oscar Isaac. And that, you know, also Alicia Vikander, who is very easy to forget, is like an actual human who's just augmented with a little bit of special effects to be this robot. But, you know, her face, her voice, it's all her there. Garland's direction is... I can see him becoming a very good director when he finds his own voice. As it is, telling the story now in someone else's, knowing that he wrote it, I'm going to give it a bump. Also because it allowed for that classic guy conversation, would you bang that robot? And any movie that allows me to have that conversation is going to get some love on this. So that is me, and that is my recommendation. Number 8, Ex Machina. Nick Newman. Number 7.
Want to give me 1 second to finish this mouthful of salmon and spinach?
Certainly. Meanwhile, Amanda, let's give you a dice roll. Number 5. That is your favorite song/score of the year.
Song/score of the year.
From a movie, though, if you do want to pick like a pop hit, we can deal with that too.
Oh, that's a tough one. Let me think. Ooh, boy. I don't know. I mean, that's a tough one. I'm just trying to think. Wait, let me look at my notes. I know there's one, and I'm trying to think of one. Man, you were asking some really... Not being prepared for these questions is tough.
Well, I will say what mine is, and it is Mad Max Fury Road.
Really?
Yeah, man, that score in that with the guy on the thing with the guitar. Awesome.
All right.
Jesus, well, fine.
I gotta say, I quite liked, and I'm gonna cover this later, I quite liked the Hitchcockian music in Tom at the Farm.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Really? You're gonna give me shit about Mad Max Fury Road score, and you're gonna go for Tom at the Farm?
I'm not giving you shit. I just didn't notice. I don't really, to be honest, I often don't really notice music that much, and I'm not that crazy about overusing music in movies. So,
meanwhile, my pop song of the year was Uptown Funk by Mark Ronson.
I'm more of a Carly Rae Jepsen fan, but hey.
Oh, God. Nick, please tell me you're done eating.
I'm right here.
All right. Number seven.
So I didn't intend for it to be this way, where basically my number eight is the most populous, my number seven is the most obscure, but sometimes that happens, doesn't it?
Yeah, so, with you especially.
Right. Thanks. Glad to be here. So my number seven film is Pedro Costa's Horse Money, which is from Portugal. This is the thing about this movie, well, one of the many things about this movie is that it is technically a sequel to his 2006 film Colossal Youth, which is itself the third part in a trilogy, sometimes referred to as Letters from Fontanas. At least it was referred to that when Criterion released a set of the trilogy in 2010. But it is very much an independent work, and one that kind of abandons the earlier movies were defined, at least the second and the third, by a certain documentary realism where it could almost, if you were to walk into a room playing the movie, you could almost think that it was a documentary that just happened to be very well lit and very well staged and shot. This one veers a bit more into the realm of science fiction and horror. It's, in a way, it's almost as if Fritz Lang had watched a lot of austere European art house and decided to make a horror movie about a Portuguese worker with a very kind of dense, grainy digital video. If that makes any sense whatsoever, that is what this movie is. It is it's a movie that's very difficult to shake because it does quite a bit to criticize not just the rulings of the Portuguese government, but in a way it's actually an autocritique for Pedro Costa himself, because the lead actor of this film is a man named Ventura, who is a construction worker in Portugal, and in the case of this movie, one of the most well-known stories about it is that there was a revolution in Portugal in the early 70s, and Pedro Costa was one of the revolutionaries who marched in with clubs, screaming and shouting and destroying things, and Ventura was one of the people who was hiding, scared for his life. And this is a movie that is sort of rooted in that event, and it kind of transposes between past, present, and future without making much of a distinction between which is which. The idea being that everything kind of exists at one given moment. And that allows the movie to do many things, have documentary realism, have science fiction elements, have horror elements, at one point have a musical sequence. That's probably my favorite scene from any movie this year. I don't know. This movie stuck a lot with me. And I also did a very long interview with Costa that's on the site where we talked a lot about it, and it kind of had me considering it in new ways. I also think it's just a really just it's this endlessly beautiful movie. So I felt like I could just sort of watch it for days on end. One thing I said about it, to just kind of keep running with these comparisons to give people some idea, I said that it's almost like a 100-minute version of the Colonel Kurtz scenes in Apocalypse Now, in terms of its composition, its rhythm, its lighting, even just its volume, the way that the volume at which people speak to each other, very much recalls that. So I'm a very, very big admirer of this movie, and I have it at number seven.
All right, Amanda Waltz, number seven.
Number seven is a movie that Nick has already talked about, Clouds of Sils Maria.
All right, that means we have to roll the dice again.
Oh, geez. Is it mine?
All right, it is yours, yeah, because you're the one doubling up.
All right.
Number two, least favorite movie of the year.
Oh, geez. well, do I really have to answer this?
Yeah, you do.
All right, fine. It was Hateful Eight.
Oh, God. How many people did we just lose to a rage quit?
Fuck them.
Right. The mean lady said something about Hateful Eight, a movie that I like.
Well, let's talk about a movie that we all liked, Clouds of Sils Maria.
Yes. So Nick pretty much covered a lot of the finer points of the film. I would say that I just love movies about movies, and I think there's a lot of that in this. There's a great discussion between the two main characters about, you know, when they go see a sci-fi film, like a cheapo kind of like Divergent type sci-fi film, and they're arguing about its merits. And, you know, I really enjoyed it because it really felt like an argument I would have with another film person. So yeah, I mean, it's just a great I think it's a great examination of like film and the star system and just what fame means. And yeah, I just thought it was a really enjoyable film, and it's shot beautifully, and it's, you know, the the location is absolutely breathtaking. So yeah.
All right, my number seven is Phoenix. This is a film that, again, we talked about on this, and it's by Christian Petzold, and it's good. It's really good. It's probably got the most impactful ending of the year. Obviously, we can't talk about that right now, but it's a very small and intimate and yet very, I don't want to say compelling or engrossing because I feel like I use those words too much, but hey, it's compelling. It's engrossing. It's a fantastic movie with a devilishly clever plot, and people should check it out. So that is my number seven, Phoenix. Check it out. Nick Newman, number six.
My number six, as previously mentioned, is John McGarry's The Mend, which is a movie that I saw in August, and I heard some pretty good things about it. Some people really quite liked it, and I was surprised because from what I heard about it, it didn't sound very appealing, just because it's this independent American dramedy, mostly comedy, about two brothers in New York, basically stuck in an apartment, sometimes including the woman that the more degenerate brother, played by Josh Lucas, is currently dating. As they sort of endure these relationship problems, and there's a power outage, and they have to face each other and face their problems, and they're debaucherous because that's so edgy and fun. I when I heard about it, I thought, okay, well, let's see what happens. And then I watched it, and it kind of knocked me on my ass a bit. This is a movie that I think is screamingly funny, for one thing. And just kind of from scene to scene, even when it's not supposed to be funny, it kind of has something that really just comes at you at 100 miles an hour, and sometimes it's a fastball that's going to strike you right in the face. And it has the best party scene of the year. I think it has the most surprising opening scene of the year. It's one of those movies that I think I find myself talking in certain hyperboles and totalizing ways, but that's just because what it does exceedingly well. It's also, you know, it's interesting too, I think, that there is this recent past of independent American films that are shot digitally that frankly just look like garbage, and I don't think is even really part of an established aesthetic so much as it is they don't have a lot of money, and so they only have so much money to buy cameras, and the cameras don't look very good unless the movies don't look very good. This is a movie that I believe was shot with the Red Viper, I think I read, and it looks really quite beautiful. I mean, this is a movie that basically from stem to stern kind of looks like a sort of like a late May, early June, end of spring, start of summer kind of glowing, flowery light. And that glowing, flowery light is encoding two very damaged people who are consistently pretty awful. But the movie doesn't revel in its own – the movie doesn't revel in that. It doesn't have a really great time with it. It uses it for the sake of humor, certainly, but it never lets the characters off easy. And I don't think the movie quite nails its climax, which I think kind of has the problem of taking a movie that in a way is almost like about everything and then narrowing it down to one thing. But I think that it sort of comes back in its final scenes to really be this movie about Basically, it's a movie about two bad people who go through a very interesting, difficult experience and come out on the other side absolutely no different whatsoever. If anything, they probably only come out worse, and things are probably only going to be worse for them in the future. And again, it's also really funny. So, yeah, this is a movie I really liked a lot. This is actually John McGarry's feature debut, and I'm very excited for whatever he might do next. It's also on Netflix. So,
yeah.
I will have to check that out because I've heard good things. Nick, also, just because I feel like it, rolling the dice. Number 5, best song or score of the year?
Well, Amanda, my favorite score of the year is Ennio Morricone's score for The Hateful Eight. Now, if you'll give me 10 minutes of your time, I have a pamphlet here. Favorite song. You're talking about favorite song in a movie, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I was just making sure. I was thinking that's kind of off topic. I think my favorite use of a song in a movie this year was maybe the final Derriere by Sparks in The Forbidden Room, which is a whole musical sequence involving Udo Kier that is on YouTube, but I think you should just see the movie to experience it for yourself firsthand. It's really, really something.
All right.
You said Udo Kier. I am there.
Yep.
I'm a
fan. All right, Amanda Waltz, number 6.
So number 6 is Iris from Albert Maysl's R.I.P. I don't think it's not his last film, because I think there's a couple other films, documentaries and post that still need to come out. But I really just fell completely in love with this movie. It's a profile of Iris Apfel, who is known as the rare bird of fashion. She is this interior designer who turned just style icon. And what I really like about the movie is that it really just is about her life. And she's very old. I'm trying to remember how old she is in this movie. But I mean, she's like 93 years old. And she's still just so witty and so candid and still working, has this great energy, and just is just a fascinating character to watch. And also, I think what I like about it is how it examines fashion and style as an art, because it's this idea, like, fashion is, you know, obviously, I think fashion is more sort of like the commercial aspect, whereas I think style is more the how you're able to actually put all of these components together. And I think that's something that this film really just depicts well, is that this is an art. Having the ability to do that well is an art, and people are, like, regardless of how you feel about fashion, regardless how you feel about style, you have to kind of admire someone who can put an outfit together. I mean, and make it look really interesting. And that's what she does. And she's also this collector. So a lot of she has all these items that she's gotten from her travels around the world. And I mean, it is just like, there's just something about the film. It's just like very, it's such a great meeting of just like completely something that's just completely superficial and completely materialistic. There's all these, you know, all the stuff that she has, and this sort of spiritual element where it's, you know, this is her life and this is what she loves and this is why she's able. But I mean, it's almost like this is why she's so old. This is why she's been alive for so long, because like she just loves just her stuff and just loves like everything, like all the beautiful things in the world. And I don't know, it's just, there's just something so weirdly, like there's a scene where she's at this sort of like at this talk, and these women go up and ask her to basically outfit them, to put an outfit together for them. And there's something about that scene, I was like shaking with excitement at how she was going to dress these women. So I don't know. It's just something, and it's, of course it's Albert Maysl. So there's just something also very poignant about it, because this, you know, he died last year. So you know, there's that element of it. And, you know, his style is still very much apparent in this profile for life. So, yeah, I don't know. I just thought it was a wonderful, pleasant little film.
All right. My number six is Ballet 422. Jody Lee Leip's documentary about the New York Ballet Company. And Justin Peck, who is a first-time choreographer who is creating the only new ballet for that year, the 422nd original ballet for the company. And it is beautifully shot, just absolutely gorgeous. Even if you don't know anything about ballet, watching the creative process is absolutely fantastic. And in addition to that, this has a kind of twist ending too that recontextualizes all the hard work that we've seen and makes it even more impressive. So that is my number six, Ballet 422, which is currently on Netflix. And now since we're at the halfway point, let's roll the dice. Nick Newman, you get number six. Favorite title?
Favorite title? I mean, The Sweet Blood of Jesus is pretty good.
I was going to say, that's a pretty damn good title.
I don't know. I think I'll default to that one, just because I can't quite think of something right now, and I like that one a lot. And more people should have seen that movie, so.
Agreed.
Yeah. Amanda Waltz.
Yes.
Number three, biggest disappointment.
Oh, biggest disappointment. Well, I feel like I've already used The Hateful Eight, so...
It's possible to be both.
I guess it can be both. It was a huge disappointment. It was.
All right.
For me.
The Hateful Eight. Least favorite of the year and biggest disappointment. All right. Nick Newman. Number five.
My number five movie, mentioned twice now, which tells you how much I liked it, is Guy Madden and Evan Johnson's The Forbidden Room. This is a movie that when someone asked me to describe it, because I wanted them to see it, I tried to figure an elevator pitch. So what I said is that this is a live-action, hard R SpongeBob SquarePants episode that's 2 hours long that decides to pay homage and, in a spiritual sense, communicate with the specters of antiquated and lost cinema and uses a cast of European all-stars to do so.
All right, Amanda Waltz.
Now,
okay. What the shit does that even mean?
Now, if you see, I swear to God that if you see the movie, that will might not make perfect sense, but you might have some idea of what I mean. This is an amazing movie that partially gets points just for the fact that every minute of this movie, as I was watching it, I thought to myself, "My God, this must have been a fucking nightmare to make," because it uses all of this. It was shot in high definition, and what Guy Madden and Evan Johnson, when I interviewed them, nudge, will tell you is a very ugly high definition that they transformed it to look like old, scratched, destroyed prints that were dragged across the street from a moving car using digital technology. And so more than being immensely entertaining and just always visually fascinating, I think that it kind of represents an important point between digital and film and how one can represent the other. And then there's also just everything else in it. Even when this movie is a series, it's basically stories within stories within stories within stories. And the main story is a submarine group, a submarine crew who are about to run out of oxygen. And so in addition to eating pancakes, because the pancakes have air pockets and that'll give them more oxygen, they decide to they have to get to this place called the Forbidden Room, which is apparently where the captain is stowed away. And along the way, they tell each other stories, and the people inside the stories tell each other stories. And it keeps going and going. And even when it doesn't work, when it doesn't work as strongly in some sections as it does in others, it still feels completely bold. And I don't know. I love this movie. I think it is a very special work. So.
All right. Amanda Waltz, number five.
Number five, Bone Tomahawk.
Woo! And you know what that means.
No.
Roll the dice.
Oh, geez. Oh, my.
Number four, favorite character.
Oh, favorite character. You know what? This relates to Bone Tomahawk, because I got to say Matthew Fox's Western Dandy in Bone Tomahawk, man, was that out of left field and wonderful and absolutely just mesmerizing to watch. Because who ever thinks about Matthew Fox? Ever.
Maybe his mom every now and then? I don't know.
Oh, that's sweet. But yeah, he's, I mean, like, what we've discussed this film, you know, on many occasions. I feel like it's probably our most talked about film of the year.
As it should be.
As it should be. It's an absolutely just, everything about it works. The writing works. The horror elements work. The Western elements work. The performances are just impeccable. And, you know, I just, like I said in our podcast, it was a huge surprise. I was not expecting this to be as good as it is. I think it really, you know, obviously it doesn't really pander to anyone, but I think if you're a Western fan, you'll love it. I think if you're a horror fan, you'll love it. You know, it's just such a versatile, lean, wonderful movie. And I just, you know, I'm really glad that we're talking about it so much.
As am I. Mm. All right. Well, that leaves me with my number five, which is Inside Out, newest film from Pixar. This charts the emotions that live inside of a young girl's head. And it is pretty incredible that Pixar, which had had down years, and then were it not for this movie, kind of would have continued to have had a down year with The Good Dinosaur, was able to create something as inventive as we expect from them, with as much heart as we expect from them. And yet, even though we expect it from them, still surprise us with the depth and level of its quality. So that is Inside Out, my number five of the year, and what a damn good film it is. Number four, Nick Newman.
You know, there's one movie that's come up on this podcast that I wasn't going to raise objection to because it's somebody's choice, and I'm going to respect that, but I am nevertheless baffled by the appreciation for. I'm not going to say what it is, but I'm just going to say that when I go into everybody on this podcast's favorite movie, Eden, by Mia Hansen-Love.
Wait, no, now you need to say what the movie you were talking about previously was.
Bone Tomahawk. You can say it.
You really don't get Bone Tomahawk?
I watched 25 minutes of it. I gotta say, I thought it was awful. Like, damn. I really, yeah.
Okay,
it was
now,
very tough.
Nick, take that reaction and apply it to me watching Hateful Eight, and I think you will understand.
You both are such huge disappointments to me.
You know, those two movies are edited by the same person, which kind of blows my mind. They are Fred Raskin.
And,
yes, and there's a part in Bone Tomahawk where a character has his arms raised in a shot, and then the next shot he just kind of has his arms down for, like, no reason. Because it's just such a badly cut together movie. And I thought that it looked quite ugly, honestly.
I think
the digitally shot Western just kind of doesn't work.
You're super weird.
It's a thing. And also Matthew Fox is the worst person.
Oh, this in the favorite character of the year.
That's all right.
All right. You know what that means?
I'm sorry.
I didn't want to
do
it. Okay.
It's cool. Nick.
Yeah.
You've rolled number three. Biggest disappointment.
Biggest disappointment. That's a good question. I think my biggest disappointment was maybe Arabian Nights by Miguel Gomez, which is the three-film, 6-hour movie that's an adaptation of Arabian Nights that is kind of a documentary about Portugal from 2013 to 2014 by Miguel Gomez, a director I'm a big fan of. This movie it's divided into three movies. The second movie is quite good. The first 45 minutes of the third movie are pretty outstanding. The rest I would never see again and be completely happy with. And the people who love this movie do really love it, and I wish I could join them in it, but I found it.
Just like people who love Bone Tomahawk.
Yes.
But Bone Tomahawk wasn't 6 hours long.
True.
Yeah. So that's a big investment.
That's true. I didn't have a problem watching it, is the thing. But I found it, I felt it never, with the exception of, you know, some, well, it's crazy to say, it's like 170 really good minutes of this movie, and it's still a disappointment. It kind of really hits its mark. Anyway, that's one that, I don't think that film has even ever been mentioned on this podcast, so I don't really feel like contextualizing it, but if it sounds remotely interesting, you should really see it, because it does a lot of things that feel new and exciting, but nevertheless, it was a disappointment. So let me talk about Eden briefly.
Yeah. Super brief.
Like, that's not fair.
No. I want to keep this moving along. And I think we talked about it a lot, and I've written so much about it at this point, like a review and so many capsules on various lists. You know, it's a movie about failure that I think isn't mopey or silly enough to embrace failure and say, hey, it's all right. You know, get them next time, slugger. and I appreciated that, especially, I think, as I was at this weird point in my life where I was kind of starting or in the middle of something really, really important in my life, and at the same time coming to an end of it, and which is a pretty personal, specific reason for responding so strongly to a movie, but I also think it's a really wonderfully made movie in a lot of ways too, as I've talked about before. So again, that's a movie like Clouds of Sils Maria, made by Mia Hansen-Love's husband, that I saw, you know, in September of 2014, but kind of has never left me, and I thought I would throw it on there. So there you go. There it is.
All right. Okay. Amanda Waltz.
Yes.
Number four.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to make me roll again.
No, you don't have to roll again.
Okay, good. So number four is Sean Baker's Tangerine. Of course, this got a lot of buzz because of the idea that it was shot on an iPhone. And it's much more than it's that hype, I think. It is a very fresh, young film. It's about these two trans women who, one of whom just got out of prison and is informed by the other that her boyfriend has been cheating on her, and so she kind of goes on a basically just on a mission to find the woman that her boyfriend cheated on her with. And so it's this really, you know, it's a lot of, I think I called it a love letter to LA, which it is in a lot of ways. I mean, this is taking place on these sort of like very, I don't know if I want to say grimy, but I mean, it's not beautiful. It doesn't portray LA as like a beautiful place. It's more sort of like this like little grimy underbelly of LA that nobody really wants to look at, but it's definitely there. But it's also portrayed very sort of like sensitively, and it's also a very diverse film. You know, the characters, you have like Maya Taylor, and you have, I can't remember. I keep wanting to call her. I call her Kiki Rodriguez. And then you have an Armenian family and an Armenian cab driver, and they all feature very prominently throughout the film. And, you know, it's actually, the way it's shot is it's very, sort of, it wants you to look at it. There are moments where it's very loud and it's very vulgar. But it's also very funny and sort of, and very bold in that way. And I think that's what really makes it work, is it's not apologetic. There's no filter. You know, it's like, here are these very sort of like down and out, characters. You know, I'm not going to make them, I'm not going to basically, show you like this beautiful world where these characters don't exist. And I really like that. So, and it's also, you know, I like the friendship element of it. I found it to be very touching. So yeah, I just, you know, it was a big, you know, I was very skeptical going into it because, like I said, there was a lot of hype. I thought it was going to be another Escape from, what was that? Escape from Tomorrow. That movie that was shot in Disney World.
Yeah, that's Escape from Tomorrow.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be another one of those where it was just this total gimmick, and it really wasn't. And it was quite a nicely made little film.
All right, my number four is an animated film, also. also related to Inside Out, not literally anything else that anyone has said. Number four for me Anomalisa. Has anyone else seen this?
It hasn't come to Pittsburgh yet, so.
Well, that's unfortunate.
I know.
You should check it out, because it's my number four. It's by Charlie Kaufman and Duke Johnson. And this is a stop-motion film that finds an older British gentleman struggling with the fact that he sees everyone's face the same and hears all their voices the same, and he feels lost and alone in a sea of mundanity until he runs into Lisa, who has a face and a voice all of her own. Obviously, this isn't the literal world, but more how he sees it. I'm hoping that we'll get a chance to talk about this film later on. So I will just say that it is heartbreaking, and I can hear myself reverberating.
Whoa.
Thank you.
That's kind of like the echo of emotions in Anomalisa.
Yeah, it's not that someone like had their mic weird. Yeah, this film is heartbreaking and hard to watch to the point that it is almost an emotional horror film. That is Anomalisa. All right. Let's go to number three. Nick Newman.
My number three is Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight, which I think I've said quite a lot about at this point. I still feel like I have more to say about, but here we are. I'm not going to say more. So
we did have a massive conversation about this.
All I will say, I find that how do I put this? So, Amanda, now.
Hold on. All right, go ahead.
I feel like I should just say your name because you were the one on the podcast who didn't like it, and I think it's interesting that we seem to react to it on a surface level in very similar ways. It was just the extent to which we were willing to go with it, or the when you're straddling the fence of the movie, which side of it you ultimately fall on. The very, I think, kind of small and the very small fence of this movie in a way. And so I don't know. That's interesting to me, because the more I talk about it, the more I like it, and the more I hear people say why they don't like it, the more I think, well, it's kind of why I like it.
And I can understand that. And I actually think I would, you know, I think you were probably the most diplomatic about it in terms of accepting my views.
He did call you a raving woman, though.
Well,
hey. If I say it jokingly, everything's fine.
This is true.
That's sort of pointing out also one of the big issues with the film. But anyway, I appreciate that, because I think a lot of people, I mean, I was having an extreme reaction to an extreme film.
Yeah.
And I don't think precisely. That's completely, you know, ridiculous.
Well, as we learned from Queen of Earth earlier this year, I mean, all women are raving lunatics. So you being a raving lunatic about a movie about a female being a raving lunatic makes sense.
We're really packing in the year here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of callbacks.
Well, nobody else mentioned Queen of Earth, so we might as well.
God willing, no one ever will.
I was shocked. I think some people put it in their honorable mentions, maybe. I didn't see it on too many lists. On the film stage, anyway.
Nope.
But yeah.
Did not crack our top 50. Hallelujah. All right. Amanda Waltz, number three. Yes.
Number three is Tom at the Farm, which by Xavier Dolan. And I know, Nick, you weren't as crazy about this film when we were talking about it.
No. Nope.
And the podcast. And I can understand that. I mean, this is a very, how do I put this? I would say I could see how this film would be maybe perceived as a little garish in some ways, just in terms of how hyper stylized it is and just how it portrays its characters. But the reason I liked it, and okay, I'll preface this with an actual description of the film. It's basically about a young French-Canadian man, a gay man, who goes to visit his lover's family after his lover dies, only they don't know that he's gay. So it's a very strange, I don't know. It's kind of strange because it's basically, he's sort of under the spell of his dead lover's brutish brother, who is both sort of weirdly blackmailing him into not saying anything about his lover being gay. I can understand why you have issues with it, but at the same time, I think really it's a great analysis of the psychology of abuse within a relationship. And I mean, he's literally isolated from everyone, and that's how, because that is basically how this British brother character, who's, I wish I could remember his name. It's Yves Pierre or Pierre Yves Cardinal. I feel really bad because I always confuse it, but he's excellent regardless. And it's kind of, and I think also it works as a great erotic thriller, just in terms of it's weird because there's no actual sex. There's just a suggestion of sex, and you almost feel kind of guilty that you're turned. I mean, maybe this is just me. I felt a little bit guilty that I was turned on by it, but I also thoroughly enjoyed it. So it's a very meaty film, I think, stylistically and in terms of how it presents its characters and just the sort of dreamlike quality of it, which I think really works. There's sort of hints of, there's a lot of horror elements to it. There's these sort of like Universal Studio type sound effects. Like there's dogs howling and there's owls hooting and things like that. And there's a scene toward the end that really reminded me of The Shining. And I really, you know, which I think really added, of course, to that sort of like a genre, like very classic genre, like horror genre element. So, but yeah, I really enjoyed it. I think one of the issues you had with it, Nick, was that you didn't think Xavier Dolan is the greatest actor.
No, I think he is neither the greatest actor nor a good actor.
I think it was fine in this case. I mean, I think, you know, it's one of those things where when someone speaks in another language, it's hard for me to really tell whether or not they're a good or bad actor. But yeah, I mean, I just really liked, the film as an erotic thriller that also kind of had this, I don't know, just the way it switched. It went from being the sort of like victim narrative to being an erotic thriller to being this strange kind of horror film. Yeah. I don't know. I like the progression, and yeah, I don't know. I just thought it was an enjoyable film.
Enjoyable enough to be number three for the year.
Mm-hmm.
My number three, Sicario, by Denis Villeneuve. This is a fantastic, tense, ramping up, crazy awesome, weird genre-bending action mystery procedural that has a great turn from Emily Blunt, an even better turn from Benicio del Toro, and a fun turn from Josh Brolin. Brilliantly lensed by Roger Deakins. I saw it, I loved it, and it hasn't changed its place on my list since that moment. So that is my number three, Sicario. Number two, Nick Newman.
My second favorite film of 2015 is Alexei Garamond's Hard to Be a God, which is a movie that takes place on an alien planet and feels like it comes directly from that alien planet. Now, are either of you familiar with the premise of this movie?
I am, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
You are? You say that so enthusiastically.
Question mark? No, I am. It's just, I haven't watched the film yet, but yeah, I'm familiar with the plot.
Okay. So, this is a movie that's kind of like Horse Money. This is a movie that at times feels like a documentary of its own making because it's filled with all of these ugly, deformed, just miserable looking people in the most uncomfortable looking medieval wear, covered in mud, covered in something what I hope is supposed to be a prop representing shit, shooting snot out of their noses, spitting on the ground, spitting on each other, gouging each other in the stomach, disemboweling each other, cutting each other's heads off, cutting each other's limbs off, throwing each other onto giant wooden spike dildos, and then rubbing the blood all over your face as some sort of macho, airless act of aggression and dominance. And this movie made me very happy. Now, I was... how do I put this? The plot of this movie is kind of not important, but I think it ultimately makes sense. It's basically just one kingdom wants to destroy the other. And it decides to depict that with these very intense close-ups, these long, long shots swooping and panning and going up and down and capturing so much in a given moment, shot in the most stark black and white. It's a movie that took 6 years to shoot and 7 years to edit, to the point where the director died before he could completely finish it. And it kind of earns that reputation. Its reputation precedes itself, but then it earns that reputation. And I think it's pretty fucking good. And you can watch it on Netflix. It is 3 hours long. It's 3 hours of that. So you kind of have to prepare yourself for it. and you have to turn off the lights. You got to just kind of settle in with a nice, you know, a nice hot cup of tea or something. And just kind of, you know, don't eat while you're watching the movie, and then just let the movie play. I think it's really quite amazing, and it just kind of – it's one of those movies that, it, like a lot of my favorite movies, it feels like it should not exist, and yet it does, and I'm glad it does.
So, well, didn't his wife and son finish the film? Am I wrong?
Yes, they did, and they are credited, I think, in the opening credits as having something like additional work by or something like that. Apparently he was very close to finishing it, and there were just some things that needed to be tidied up. And so they kind of swooped in and fixed it.
So it's like a family movie.
It's like it is a family effort. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mandelbaltz, number two.
Number two. Ex Machina.
Woo.
Yeah.
What that means... We can't roll again because you only have one thing left. So,
well,
all I need from you is your favorite line.
Oh, favorite line. Actually, I was looking through my notes because I wanted to be prepared for this. And I gotta say, it's probably the line from... I don't know what it was. There's something about Magic Mike XXL... that I wasn't quite sure if I was going to like it. And then somebody said, I really need to try Molly in one scene. And okay, for some reason I was like, oh, all right. I don't know what it was. It was just the way, like, I think in the context of the scene, it probably makes a little bit more sense, but just that I really need to try Molly.
Okay. So Ex Machina, you're number two.
Ex Machina, number two. Yeah, I mean, what more can we really say about this film that hasn't already been said?
All right, my number two.
Yeah, let's do it. I think it's a very smart and yet very, I guess, self-effacing film, just in the way it sort of makes fun of all the arguments against AI, the sort of stock arguments against AI technology. I really enjoyed. Of course, it has my heart's desire in it. So, and he's just fantastic as a bro tech guy, like tech millionaire. Just wonderful.
Right.
And D. Gleason, this year's D. Gleason, the 200 D. Gleason, the 2015 movie MVP.
Who's been
pretty much every single movie.
My number two is a little animated film called Shaun the Sheep. What the hell was that noise?
I don't know.
All right. Shaun the Sheep, stop motion film from Aardman Animation. This is a story about a sheep that goes to the big city to find his farmer. And it's hilarious. It's just straight up amazing. The weird cartoon logic of the world works really well. The expressions of all of the creatures are weirdly like emotive and really touching. And yeah, it's just a fantastic, wonderful little film. Taps into the spirit of Buster Keaton and does it like no other film this year. So that's my number two, Nick Newman. Number one of 2015.
My number one film of 2015 is Alex Ross Perry's Queen of Now.
Oh God, I would fucking, I would just turn this off. I would do so many bad things.
No, it is not. Rest your easy heart. My number one movie of 2015 is Bertrand Bonello's Saint Laurent, which is a movie that I saw in June and I knew I really, really quite liked. I think the words I used afterwards were near masterpiece, which I didn't go whole hog with it on that viewing just because there were certain things about it I needed to reconcile. The many kind of wrinkles and not inconsistencies, but the peculiarities of it were sort of sitting with me in ways I couldn't quite figure out. And then the more I thought about it, I just found that perhaps it doesn't quite wrinkle out everything. I don't know. Perhaps it doesn't smooth out everything, every wrinkle. I don't know. But when it is on, which is almost all the time, it is as on as any movie I saw this year. I remember someone described this as if Scorsese directed in Marcel Proust adaptation, which I think kind of sums it up pretty well in the way that this movie mixes drugs and sex and music and flashing lights and clubs and fashion and excess of every kind, and also uses a very peculiar flashback structure that announces itself as kind of a intentionally fake film, a movie that kind of has fake sets and doesn't even make certain what's going on in a particular shot. And the way that does that, the way that it kind of narrows in on its various ideas and points while also constantly expanding itself and kind of seeming limitless, I think is amazing. It also features this movie climaxes in maybe the best split screen shot I've ever seen. It's actually a multi-tiered split screen shot that it divides the image up into, I think, like seven planes of action. And it's all a fashion runway scene, one model after the other, one model at the same time as the other. Saint Laurent, played by Gaspar Ulliel, looking on all the while, this, you know, blaring 70s funk music playing. And it's very exciting and it's very kind of ostentatious, but it doesn't feel unearned in any way.
This was one of two biopics about Saint Laurent, wasn't it?
It was. I never saw the other one. I heard the other one was bad and I just kind of had no interest in it.
I watched it. It wasn't that bad. It was okay.
Okay. I didn't see it. I'd be curious to see it now, considering how much I like this, but I really saw this because I'm a big fan of Bertrand Bonello, who I think is sort of secretly one of our great working filmmakers. And I say secretly because he doesn't really get a lot of attention when his movies come out, but this is a really outstanding movie. And I kind of found myself thinking about it constantly for days and weeks and months. And I don't know. It felt right to do this because I think that this is admittedly kind of a political choice because as if this is really going to shake up the cinematic world. But what I mean by that is just that this is a movie that didn't really get a lot of attention when it came out. And a lot of people kind of said, well, this just sticks to standard biopic conventions and it feels like Bonello is limited by his choice and subject. I call bullshit on that. If this film was about a completely fictional person and was entirely the same from stem to stern, that complaint would not exist. The critical reception would be different. That complaint is bullshit. Wow. I'm going to say that again. That complaint is bullshit. People need to get over their biopic problem. Because if they're going to look at a movie like this and they're going to throw that out, they've got their head up their ass. So I'm coming out swinging for this movie. This is a great film. And look, if you don't like it, fine. But the way that people approach it, I thought was really disappointing. And I just kind of, I think it's great. It deserves to be here. It deserves the attention. So there it is. Bertrand Bonello's Saint Laurent.
All right. Amanda Waltz, number one.
Oh, geez. What is my number one?
Hateful Eight. Ha
ha, psych. I really loved it. No, it's a... No, not at all. It is Mad Max Fury Road from the great George Miller. And I mean, I've said, of course, you know, we had a very extensive podcast about this, and I've written about it and everything. And really what I just want to say is I know that, you know, people obviously want to talk about just the more, you know, you want to talk about like the incredible action sequences. You want to talk about like what an amazing just display of not only just stunt work and just incredible imagination, just, you know, and obviously, you know, people want to talk about how it's an anti-patriarchal film and it's, you know, it's very, has some intelligence behind it. But really, I mean, what floors me about this movie, and I hate to use a Peter Travers word, but like, is just, it is a goddamn weird movie. And the idea that a movie this weird can be a popular, not just a popular film, but a critically acclaimed film is so impressive to me and such a, like, almost like a relief to me.
It's
in a lot of ways.
Floors, yeah.
It is, but it is. Like, if you really, everyone wants to talk about, you know, like, oh, you know, it's a weird-ass film. I mean, it's just like, if you really sat and thought about it and looked at it, 20 years ago, this movie would not be a huge blockbuster hit. It would be like a weird little outsider film that like nobody had really heard of and, you know, might appear sometimes in lists of like movies you've never seen before, but are really great. But I mean, it is like, this is a weird ass movie and I love it. It is just such a, I don't know. It's just such an incredible, and obviously I like I said before, I'm a huge fan of just the Mad Max series in general. But and it just makes me so excited for the possibility of a sequel, just because I just want to continue being in this world, in this just insane world. So, yeah, that's my take on it.
All right. My number one film of the year is a little animated movie by a man named Don Hertzfeldt. And it is World of Tomorrow, the short film that I have watched more times than I can count. It is the story of a young girl named Emily who is contacted by a third-generation clone of herself because the clone wants to update her on how the world is going. And this is one of the smartest, funniest, saddest, just flat-out most inventive movies ever. And it packs a lot of ideas and laughs into a scant 16 minutes. And in fact, I want to play a clip right now, so...
No, Emily, I am not your grandmother. In a sense, you are mine. I am Emily.
Emily.
For those who cannot afford the cloning process, many of our elderly undergo a full digital transfer of consciousness where they can experience a safe, extended lifespan of hundreds of years. Our grandfather's digital consciousness currently resides in this cube where I upload the latest films and books for him to enjoy every week.
Grandpa.
We are also able to download correspondence from him. Over 1,000 letters were received during his first hour in storage, as this was approximately 4 years' time inside the cube. I will read one of his letters to you now. Oh God, oh God, oh God, oh my God, Holy Mother of God, oh God. The end of life procedures for our...
And I mean, that's, like, there's so much to unpack in just that like minute, and there's 16 of those guys, and it never stops. It is both hugely universal and deeply personal, and the animation is just nonstop wonderful. So, yeah, that is it. World of Tomorrow is my number one, and it got there early, and nothing topped it, which is what happens a lot of times for my number ones. So that's it. I hope you people are happy because people kept wondering where this was and we kept putting it off. Thank you, The Revenant. All right, guys, let's tell the people where we can be found between now and the next time we talk to them. Nick Newman.
You can find me at twitter.com/Nick_Newman and thefilmstage.com.
Amanda Waltz.
You can find me on Twitter at Media Waltz, also Letterboxd Media Waltz, and you can find my blog Steel Cinema on WordPress.
And you can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. You can find me on Film Stage, where we actually just published a list of our 50 most anticipated films of 2016.
I think it's 100.
100, maybe? Some amount of films that we anticipate this year. And my personal site, dearfilm.net. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much, and join us next time.